Hello everyone, I'm Jorge Fascinetti, and this is another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Maria Flecheroux to our microphones. She is Professor of Medicine and Neurological Surgery and Director of the Pituitary Center at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and the immediate past president of the Pituitary Society. Dr. Flecheroux has a long-standing clinical and research interest in the pathophysiology and treatment of pituitary and adrenal disorders. She is a frequent guest speaker at national and international meetings on the treatment of Cushing's acromegaly growth hormone deficiency and a principal investigator in clinical trials. She has authored over 170 manuscripts in prestigious journals. Our discussion focused on the latest medical therapies employed for patients with Cushing's disease, the different classes and types of drugs that can be used to manage residual or current Cushing's disease, and importantly, how they work. We discussed a new drug currently under development, which was recently announced in a press release from Strongbridge Pharmaceuticals, describing very positive news on a new drug called levoketoconazole, and where Dr. Flecheroux was a principal investigator. We asked Dr. Flecheroux about the study and prospects for new therapies later in the podcast. Here's my chat with Dr. Flecheroux. Well, we're here with Dr. Maria Flecheroux from the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and I'm sure you are dealing with amazing amounts of smoke and COVID to add to it.
Thank you for inviting me to speak on your network. I always follow your podcast in talking to patients and physicians, and thank you for raising awareness about pituitary diseases and especially Cushing's and acromegaly. Going back to your questions, yes, we have a lot of smoke. If you can believe it, we're happy that we're not in evacuation mode. We have been very, very busy at the hospital. The COVID cases in Portland area and in Oregon overall were lower than in other parts of the country because we have strict preventive measures that everyone is following, and I'm pleased to say that. However, this is also because we moved a lot of the visits to limit patients with severe diseases to come to clinic. We moved them to telemedicine. So I'm pleased to say that the first week that we closed down, because I was already set up for telemedicine, we were able to move all the visits to do them remotely.
Yeah, well, it's a good, probably not the best, but it's a very good option that we have today with technology. So today, we're going to talk about a new drug that you've been involved in the studies, and it's called, I'm going to probably mispronounce it, levoketoconazole. Did I say that right?
It's called levoketoconazole.
Levoketoconazole. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm always, you know, with drug names, it's always so, you know, and some of the names are, oh my God, how did they name that drug? This, you know, it's pretty
That's true. Yeah.
But anyway, but I thought that we would give our audience a little bit more of a broader view of your practice. And I was going to ask you to first talk about medical therapy that might be employed with patients with Cushing's disease, because this new drug is a new drug for Cushing's.
Yes, this drug is a new drug that studied, has not been approved yet for Cushing's syndrome. But let's step back and discuss about medical therapy for Cushing's disease and Cushing's syndrome in general.
Perfect.
Because I think over the last several years, the area is becoming fascinating. We're over 100 years since Harvey Cushing's described Cushing's disease, and until 2012, we had zero drugs approved for Cushing's.
Isn't that amazing?
Since then, we already had three drugs that work for Cushing's, two approved directly for Cushing's, and one for hyperglycemia associated with Cushing's. And we had two phase three trials for levoketoconazole that's not yet approved. So which are the patients that will benefit of medical therapy? So in my mind, for patients with Cushing's disease, the first line is still transsphenoidal surgery. Some patients cannot have surgery.
Sure.
Some patients have a small tumor that's not actually visible on the MRI. And if you don't have an experienced surgeon, sometimes these patients initially would benefit of medical therapy rather than a surgery that won't cure the patient and will have complications. And then if the tumor is larger, even in the best surgeon hands, the remission rate is less than 70%. For larger tumors could be even 50%. Mm-hmm. On top of that, just to see the scope of this, for the more we learn about it and the more we studied, the recurrence rate over time could be up to 20 years and ends up, that depends on the publications, being 25, even 35%. So that shows that overall, if you add the patients that are not in remission after surgery, plus the patients that are actually recurring, you end up with more than 40% of patients that will need medical therapy. Some reviews are saying even 50% over lifetime. So that's half. These patients, of course, at some point will benefit of other therapies as repeat surgery, bilateral adrenalectomy, radiation. I know we're not focusing on that right now, but there are also other options. For medical therapy, we have drugs that work at the pituitary level, and they are somatostatin receptor ligands, espesiriotide, both sub-Q and long-acting injection once a month that have been approved by FDA for Cushing's disease. They worked at the pituitary level, decreased the ACTH, subsequently decreased the cortisol. They have the disadvantage of hyperglycemia in more than 60% of patients. All the other adverse effects are probably around the same as other somatostatin receptor ligands that we use for acromegaly, for example. Other drugs that work at the pituitary level are dopamine agonists, as cabergoline. The issue, cabergoline is a very good drug and works wonders for prolactinomas.
Yes.
Also works in combination for acromegaly. However, for Cushing's as a single drug, the results are very discordant. Some prospective studies show that it doesn't really work. In some retrospective studies, it did work. We presented, we haven't published yet, coming soon, the data on combination of pasireotide with cabergoline. So adding cabergoline as a combination therapy clearly has some benefits. As a single therapy, you need very high doses. And now we know that with higher doses, there are valvular issues. And in addition to that, us and others have shown that cabergoline in some patients, this was not well recognized before, it's increasing the risk of psychological disorders, mm-hmm. not just depression per se, but also impulse control disorders like gambling,
mental health issues,
and other problems. So we try to avoid very high doses. That being said, sometimes I'm adding on. I have to say, I don't think I have many patients that I have tried cabergoline as single therapy for Cushing's.
Yeah.
For Cushing's, we also have drugs that are called adrenal steroidogenesis inhibitors. This is a full name. So what that means
is... That's a mouthful.
The drugs work at the adrenal level. So even if it's Cushing's disease and the disease is related to a tumor secreting ACTH, yeah. they work at the adrenal level, blocking the cortisol secretion. Now, the cortisol, as we all know, comes from cholesterol, and it's splitted by so many enzymes that usually we all study every time before every board, and we look at the graphs, and then we forget a quarter of it by the next year, and yeah. so on. But it's fascinating because depending on which enzyme you block, you get different results. So several of the drugs that we have available that are working as an adrenal steroidogenesis inhibitors are osilodrostat that has been recently approved by FDA
mm-hmm.
This year. We have been doing studies with that drug. the first one, the proof of concept, we published, I think, 2012. So since then, we did a phase two and subsequently a phase three that was published this year. And now the drug is approved. That drug, osilodostat, it's blocking the 11 beta hydroxylase, and it's also an aldosterone synthetase. What we're using now for many, many years are all, because osilodostat is just recently approved, off-label drugs. Off-labels means they have not been approved for Cushing's by the FDA. Ketoconazole, this has been used by us, and in Europe it's now approved for many, many years, and I can talk later a little bit about it when we'll talk
yeah,
about
it. Yeah, I was going to ask,
ketoconazole.
Yeah, and the difference, no, because they sound so similar. It's
exactly, yeah, so we'll focus on that.
Yeah.
Other drugs that we have used off-label are metirapone, that it's on and off available in US. Again, this has been approved in Europe. Mitotane, extremely, extremely rare. It's approved for adrenal cancer. There are some countries in Europe that are using for Cushing's disease, but I have never used it for Cushing's disease. Mm-hmm. And another drug, very interestingly, and probably your listener heard about it for different reasons, it's etomidate. So that's a drug that's used in an aesthetic, but also can block the cortisol secretion.
Interesting.
So the advantage of that drug is it's available just intravenously. So we, for the patients that are really, really sick, we admit them to ICU and we give them IV because they are so sick and intubated they can't even take oral. And then we try to decrease their cortisol before surgery or just to have them controlled for a special procedure. So extremely, extremely rare we use that drug too. Again, not approved for Cushing's.
Yeah.
So these are in general, and more recently in clinical trial, we have used levoketoconazole that we're going to talk later about it.
Yeah.
And as another group per se, approved for hyperglycemia associated with Cushing's syndrome, both Cushing's disease and other causes of Cushing's, are the glucocorticoid receptor blockers. And the approved one is mifepristone. So that works by not at the pituitary level, not blocking the adrenal secretion, it's blocking the glucocorticoid receptor. So by blocking that, you have the effects of having less cortisol and glucocorticoids in general at the cellular level. So then we see, that's why it's approved for hyperglycemia, because we see diabetes improvement and also improvement in clinical features. It's another one, relacorilant, that's in clinical trials right now. But blocking the cortisol, we can't measure cortisol to look at the effects. For the other drugs, the note is that we can measure both cortisol and in the blood and UFC.
Yeah. Every time I talk to a professional, a scientist like you, a physician, it's amazing how complicated it sounds. And the good news, I guess, for the patient community is that there's so much activity now. Because I remember even 10 years ago, there wasn't that much research going on. It seems like there's at least maybe it's because I'm becoming more aware of it, obviously, but there seems to be a lot more activity in Cushing's development. And it feels like you're every day with every new patient you see or every new study, you learn something new. There are more questions to be answered. And that it's got to be professionally fascinating.
You're correct that that's very, very interesting, and it makes our life more interesting, but also seeing the medications and the drugs that we have worked with in clinical trials and in development, in some of them I have been involved since proof of concept, and then seeing it approved and improving both biochemical the numbers, but also the patients feeling back better. it's a significant satisfaction. One patient at a time, we still don't have a therapy that's helping everybody. And I'm focusing on when discussing with a patient and also when discussing with other doctors in the continuing medical education to highlight that for rare diseases, the patient should be the focus and individualized treatment is key. That's why we need more therapies, because each patient is different. We have to look at, yes, mechanism of action, how the drug works, how it's tolerated by the patient, what the patient prefers. We have to look at safety, efficacy, and then moving to combination therapy as needed. But both for Cushing's and for acromegaly, for that matter, individualized therapy should be the future. And the more therapies we have, the better we'll be able to cope with finding the right treatment for each patient.
So let's talk a little bit about levoketoconazole and the newest. Could you tell me the concept or the basis of how this clinical trial was conducted so that patients may understand how the drug was tested and how it just first came conceptually, how it first came to fruition?
Definitely, that's very important. So let's step back, and we said that we'll go back to ketoconazole. So ketoconazole, it's an antifungal treatment that's a racemic mixture of two enantiomers. So rigorous prospective studies in Cushing's have never been conducted. So we use ketoconazole off-label for a while, but we do not have approved information specific for using Cushing's. So we use it differently. And furthermore, it has been associated with a risk for hepatotoxicity in observational studies. So we know that. And the labeling...
Toxicity in the liver, correct?
Toxicity in the liver, yes. Thank you. And the labeling provides warning related to this, to hepatotoxicity, to drug interactions and QT prolongation, because the ketoconazole is not approved for Cushing's, but it's an antifungal, so it's approved on an antifungal. So all these warnings are good, but they are actually worrying some of the providers and also some of the patients. Levoketoconazole, it's not ketoconazole. The active ingredient in the new drug Recorlev, the levoketoconazole, it's a purified enantiomer. And it's regarded, by the way, by the FDA as a new active ingredient. So based on recent data, levoketoconazole may be a more potent inhibitor of cortisol synthesis when we compare with ketoconazole. And the idea for the development of this drug, the levoketoconazole, was to have a new option to treat patients with Cushing syndrome. We still have, as I said earlier, many unmet needs. One that will build on clinical practice knowledge gained from keto, but also with these studies that both Sonics and now interim data from Logic to have a rigorous evidence and disease-specific data to support the use. So we know exactly when we should use the drug, how it works, and what to do next. So there are two studies. The first study that we did was Sonic study, and were both this and the second one, Logics, were two multinational studies that were planning of evaluating the safety and efficacy of Recorlev for endogenous Cushing syndrome. So all causes of Cushing's, not just Cushing's disease. And then it's another study, Optics, that was the long-term extension data of this study. So the Sonics data, we have recently published in Lancet and Diabetes and Endocrinology, and we show that the drug met its primary and key secondary endpoints and demonstrated a statistically significant normalization rate of urinary free cortisol at 6 months. What we also shown in Sonics study, we shown that the drug showed clinically meaningful reductions from baseline at the end of maintenance treatment in several key predefined secondary endpoints, notably the LDL and total cholesterol, glycemia, and weight loss. And this accompanied the marked improvement in UFC. So in this study, the clinically meaningful benefits that show the potential for Ricorlev or ketoconazole to affect the Cushing's syndrome cardiovascular comorbidities. We know that these are the main ones that are associated with excess mortality, substantial morbidity, and high cost of care. The LOGIC study, the more recent one, that the interim data has been available last week, was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized withdrawal study of Ricorlev designed to supplement the long-term efficacy and safety information that we had in SONICS before. So what was interesting for this study was that all patients have been treated with a drug, and then they enter a phase of randomized withdrawal. So some of the patients continue the drug and some of the patients were off drug. So we know for sure in the differences, and I can give you more details soon, that the effects were of the drug itself when we compare them with placebo. The inclusion criteria for LOGIC were very similar with the one from SONICS. The patients had to have confirmed Cushing syndrome, and furthermore, they had to have urinary free cortisol that was more than 1.5 times upper limit of normal, and it was a mean of several urinary free cortisol. Why it's important for the studies to have a mean is we've shown in other studies that the variability of urinary free cortisol is very high. Sometimes from one day to the other could be 50%. So unless you have a mean,
it's the average,
and that's why it's important to have clinical trials, is very hard. So I compare when I talk to physicians, and you will know this very well, the UFC is as complicated as IGF-1 assays. So it's very from one to one and also varying from day to day. I would say even a little bit more than IGF-1. So patients prior to the randomized withdrawal, 79 study participants, and this is a lot of patients for Cushing's, that's a rare disease, entered a single arm open label titration and then a maintenance phase of approximately 14 to 19 weeks, depending when they were controlled. And then 44 patients, including five were randomized directly from SONICS, entered the 8-week randomized withdrawal portion, 22 to the drug, to the levoketoconazole, Ricorlev, and 22 to placebo, and 43 patients completely the randomized withdrawal phase. So the results have been made public last week, and
sorry for interrupting, but I should say we will put a link to the study or summary of the study that may be easy for patients to read if it's available. We can put a link on the website.
What it showed, the LOGIC study, that at the end of the randomized withdrawal phase, 54.5% more patients who were withdrawn to placebo had a loss of UFC response compared with the one that remained on Ricorlev. So the statistical significance was huge. That was 95.5% versus 40.9%. So this was clearly not variation in UFC, as I said earlier. This was clearly effect of the drug. The secondary endpoint of the study, normalization at UFC at the end of randomized withdrawal phase, was also highly statistically significant with 45.5% more patients treated with Ricorlev maintaining UFC normalization in the active arm than the placebo arm. So 50% versus 4.5% respectively. Again, very, very statistically significant. Of course, some patients had adverse events. Overall, the Ricorlev was well tolerated. 19% of the 79 patients initially dosed, discontinuing during titration maintenance phase due to adverse events. So this, we see this in all the clinical trials.
Could you explain titration? That means adjusting the dose?
Titration means adjusting the dose, sometimes up, sometimes down. Usually we call titration when it's up, and it's up titration, we just shorten it to increase efficacy. However, you are correct. Titration sometimes means down, because the patient can tolerate it very well, and then you have to decrease the dose. Rarely we have to stop. This was a clinical trial, but even in real life, if the patient has adrenal insufficiency, see, because you see this with every drug for that's blocking the cortisol and treating the Cushing's. If this is the case, then you have to stop the drug. So this, as every other drug, is not for all patients. As I have said, 19% discontinue the, because of the adverse event. But the randomized patients, the 44 randomized patients, none of them discontinued because of the adverse events. And the most common adverse event for nausea, hypokalemia, headache, hypertension, diarrhea. So in general, some of these could have been related to mild signs of withdrawal or adrenal insufficiency per se when we look overall. And I wanted to point out that what we're talking about right now might slightly change when we have the final study results, because this was an interim analysis. As we sometimes see for all the studies, small variation overall when we look at all the complete data set. So overall, I'm confident that we have, with, both with Sonics and with Logics, we have strong data that levoketoconazole was well tolerated overall. And we can say that it wasn't directly comparing with ketoconazole in neither of these studies. But if you look at this, comparing with previous observational studies for ketoconazole, then seems that levoketoconazole has lower liver toxicity than ketoconazole per se. But I think we need more data overall because the what we are comparing, this is these are different studies.
I asked Dr. Flesher to relate the current COVID vaccine study currently on phase 3 of an accelerated development in relation to the Cushing's drug development, which are also, as she mentioned, on phase 3. This is what she said.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. I think that COVID vaccine are all of them or an accelerated approval lines, and I hope this is the case. We all need it. Of course, we need drugs for Cushing's too. So both of the studies that I mentioned are indeed phase 3 trials. So both of them are phase 3. Usually, I can't comment about this drug in particular, but in general, from the finishing of the phase 3 trial with the availability of the drug, if it's approved or not approved, that depends. Sometimes, as we know, for acromegaly for a drug, the FDA required more studies and then delayed. So I can't tell you about a timeline per se.
It sounds like a rule number one of drug development is you have to be ready for anything, right? as you move forward to the final approval and commercialization of it.
Definitely. I'm lucky that working for the university, we're part just of the research. And when we're part of the steering committees, we design and help design the studies per se, but we don't have to worry about anything else besides science. So that's the beauty of working in an academic place. On another line, I recently presented last week to the European Society of Endocrinology meeting that was online.
Yes, I saw parts of it. Very interesting.
Very interesting, and on a different time zone. we presented the extension for the levoketoconazole. So what was also interesting there was that the adherence to treatment, even in a clinical trial, an extension, seemed lower 12 months versus 6 months. So we have to work more and think more how to do that with everything that's going on in the world. I'm sure that it's very hard for anybody to take any type of medication. But this is an oral medication, so should be easier than the injection. However, we like to see in these hard times to see new data from clinical trials. And both Logix and Sonix results indicate that Recorlev may be an effective and well-tolerated cortisol synthesis inhibitor. So let's hope that this will help support Cushing's syndrome patients who are not well controlled with current therapies.
Yeah, sounds like there's a very good chance that this will move forward. And you never know, of course, but it's always important to add as many tools as possible. Well, we're always interested in letting people know about these trials, because I think the more education and the more we can expose people on how things happen, the more interested they become in their disease and the more engaged they are to help to work with their physicians to get better. So like you're saying, engagement is critical, and we hope to make a difference with that.
Definitely. And again, thank you for doing that, increasing awareness about the disease, increasing awareness about treatments, highlighting that we should be able to find a treatment for each patient, and the pros and cons differ in function of patient. And especially for Cushing's, where the high cortisol affects both the body and the mind itself, we clearly need more therapies.
So is there anything that I didn't ask you that you would like to cover? What keeps you up at night? You know, what sort of things do you think about
it? So right now there are a lot of issues that keep me at night, but that's a different era. So for Cushing's in general, I think that we have, and I briefly mentioned, we should be focused not just on therapy itself, that it's the focus of my work and research. However, mm-hmm. I think we're still very far behind with the diagnosis. So diagnosis is still delayed with 4 to 5 years, studies show both here and in Europe and even more. And we still don't know how to do that. We need better assays for screening and confirmation, how to make sure that the patient that has high cortisol actually ends up having confirmed Cushing's in a timely manner. Because mm-hmm. high cortisol could be increased by a lot of other comorbidities. We know now, and we have recently published, that there are some complications that were not very well prepared to prevent. Hypercoagulability, for example, for Cushing's, it's much more prevalent. We published both our data, but also we did a meta-analysis. And in the meta-analysis that did not include our data at that time, was that the risk of a patient with Cushing's compared with the normal population was 18 times more to develop a blood clot. So that's very high. So we should work more on using heparin, other types of anticoagulants, but then we need to find out how to properly use them, because you use them before surgery and the patient will bleed. So we need, again, it's a balance and working in a multidisciplinary approach, but it's something that we should move towards some type of guidelines that the Pituitary Society is working right now. What we also need to look at is, similar to diabetes, we should probably think more about cardiovascular disease in Cushing's and how to look at some increased risk factors, even if the patients don't have diabetes. Right now, for example, if you have diabetes, even your goal for cholesterol is different on treatment. So that's right. We should think this as for Cushing's also, and for acromegaly for that matter, anything that's increasing the risk of cardiovascular disease. For treatments, we need, as I said, more medical treatments overall. However, improvements in surgery change over time. Radiation, it's possible that a new type of radiation will have longer-term, less adverse events. We don't really know yet. Since that hypopit is about the same, but at least risk of second cancers. And I think that the most important thing would be to get it much more clear set up in US for the Pituitary Center of Excellence that us and others have started for a while, but to have like clear designations, and also for the patients want to be seen in a large center. what we have right now problems is mostly related to the insurances that are denying the patient to be seen, because most of the center of excellence are large universities and we're out of network for some patients.
Yeah, I know. We hear from patients all the time that want to be seen at large centers, at super, super specialists. And it's an issue, you know, so that's something that from a public policy point of view, we need to get our hands around and see if we can influence from the patient standpoint some of the public policy and insurance issues.
I think that would be great if you can spearhead something like this. It's done in Europe. It has been shown that it works well for many rare diseases. And the patients at least once a year, though it's distance, there are different rules, they can see these specialists all the time. But at least once a year, they are seen and they benefit of the newest therapy. Yeah. And not so much about the specialist just as a neuroendocrinologist that we are. I'm not practicing anything else besides neuroendocrinology. So I do this day in and day out compared with my colleagues that are doing general endocrinology, that they know way more about other diseases, including diabetes and everything else. But for example, in our center, we send patients, if they have diabetes and it's harder to control, I'm sending them to the diabetes clinic. If they have fracture because they had Cushing's when they were diagnosed, I'm sending them at least for a consult, though I'm an endocrinologist and I know about fractures and treatment. I want them to get the best doctor that is focusing just on fractures.
So it's a multidisciplinary approach that's so...
Even in neuroendocrinology, not talking about the fact that I'm in clinic with a surgeon all the time, and neuro-ophthalmologist is not on the same floor with us, but it's on a floor above, and the neuroradiologist, it's a floor underneath us. So the multidisciplinary approach and the collegiality, and you know exactly what would be the plan and the discussions in between, and the tumor board reports and the case conferences give the opportunity for the trainees to learn, and also for patients to have the best outcomes.
Well, Dr. Flesher, I want to thank you because this has been really a great, great conversation. I am definitely going to invite you back to talk about things that we could just spend the whole afternoon talking about so many things. So we would love to have you back and invite you to chat with us about other very important issues for patients. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you again. It was a pleasure.
This has been another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. And a quick reminder that if you want to contribute to our effort, you can do so by going to our site at pituitaryworldnews.org, check on Get Involved, and follow the prompts. Thank you. And thank you for listening.